The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. We are about a week away from the trade deadline. February 10th is sneaking up fast. The whole league, it seems, is waiting on a Ben Simmons deal. There's renewed buzz surrounding Bradley Beal. The Knicks seem ready to do, well, something. Of course, it's never all that simple. NBA trades are hard to do. But my guest today has made a lot of them, especially in season deals and trade deadline deals. He is former Nets and Sixers GM Billy King. Billy, of course, ran the Nets from 2010 to 2016 and was GM of the Sixers from 1998 through 2007. He's currently co-hosting a sports talk show on WIP in Philadelphia, where he lives, and he's also a contributor to NBA TV. We get into the Ben Simmons situation, of course, talk a little Kyrie Irving. Should the Nets actually be entertaining a possible Kyrie deal right now? Should the Grizzlies and Cavs be all in now that they've broken through? And we discuss a lot of Billy's key deadline deals, including the two almost deals that could have changed the course of the Nets. Yes, that's right. We will discuss the melodrama and the Dwightmare. Before we get to all that, a reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the YouTube version. Just search Sports Illustrated Podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Billy King is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by Billy King. BK, how are you, sir?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Good to see you. Been a while. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it. We are, just to set this up for the listeners, we're talking 8 days out from the trade deadline, but this is going to run on Friday the 4th. So if anything happens, people, and somebody gets traded, it's not my fault. It's not Billy's fault.
Blame Howard.
blame me. It's fine. And I want to get into all that, Billy. I want to talk about a little about this trade deadline and the situation across the league and some specific situations. And I also want to talk a little bit about just, you know, your own experiences with many, many trade deadlines past with the Nets, with the Sixers, during your time with both organizations. But before we get to that, I want to jump or just start off with this Brian Flores situation in the NFL, because this just happened. As I mentioned, we're recording this on Wednesday the 2nd. A lot of this has just hit. The lawsuit that he has filed alleging racial discrimination on the part of the NFL, lack of opportunities for black coaches in the NFL. You have a long track record in the NBA in front offices. You know how difficult it's been in the NBA at times. But to give the full picture here, Billy, before I jump in and get your thoughts on this, the NBA, of course, among the major leagues in this country, generally grades pretty well. Richard Lapchick, who does the annual grades for the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport, gives the NBA high marks every year. They got an A in 2021, but it's not perfect by any means. There are 13 black head coaches in the NBA right now, but that's the highest it's been in about 10 years. It was hovering around like an average of 7 for several years. Heads of basketball operations, whether that's as team president with some organizations or general manager with others. These labels, these titles are kind of interchangeable sometimes. There are 10 black GMs or presidents right now in the NBA, but not all of them are actually the last stop, right?
Yeah.
In fact, it might only be four or five. You know, Elton Brand is listed on these lists, but Elton Brand is reporting to
Delmore,
of course. Scott Perry with the Knicks is reporting to Leon Rose. Mark Eversley in Chicago reporting to Arturnis Karnisovas. So there's that one's a little bit squishy sometimes. So just in general, Billy, knowing the NBA as you do, and you're also doing a lot of radio in Philadelphia, so you are paying attention to all the sports in the NFL too. You got a sense of this. What are your thoughts initially on the Brian Flores suit, and does this have any implications, do you think, for the NBA as well?
Well, I think you start with the fact that you have to have a Rooney rule. Then that tells you that the league itself knows that they have a problem. And so to me, that is the problem I foresee that they have, is that they had to put a rule in place. And I don't know if it's as much as institutional racism or institutional biases. I just think that a lot of these owners are never put into the room to get to know some of these people that they could hire. And so that becomes the problem. I think they tend to hire who they know, who they're comfortable with. And if you look at it, that's what they're hiring. They may know a head coach who's white, or a general manager's white, and they make a recommendation and it may not be of somebody of color. And I think that is the problem, is I think the league in itself doesn't put themselves in a position where these potential candidates are in the same room with some of these other coaches. And that's where the problem lies. But when you have a Rooney rule, you're saying we had a problem. And I think when you have a Rooney rule also, it forces people to just check a box. And to me, it's the discussion's got to start further. Is like, who are you looking at as candidates? Why are you looking at these candidates? The NBA for itself has done a better job of reaching out to owners and here's potential candidate. Here's some names of guys. We're not saying you have to hire these guys, but here's some guys you may not know. And to me, that's where the league should be doing a better job. But in NFL, not being an owner, I look at it, I know that, Tampa Bay has a black offensive coordinator, a black defensive coordinator, so I know being a novice that they're there. So to me, there's a deeper issue that I think the league itself needs to address. And I think what this lawsuit will do, it will force them to give information on their hiring practices, which I think some of these owners don't want to do, but that is the only way probably Brian Flores felt to get this information out there, is to file a lawsuit. So then during discovery, you have to find out, what are your practices? Who did you talk to? How many times did you talk to them? Did you have this person hired before you interviewed me? So it'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out. But he took a big stance, because, his career coaching wise in the pro level may be over, but I think he's doing it not just for himself, but for his brethren.
Yeah, no, I admire the stance, because he very much might be sacrificing his career in a different way than, say, Colin Kaepernick did with his own stance in the NFL. But we know how the NFL views anybody trying to speak up on behalf of equality, equity, fairness. They don't take kindly to it. It's interesting, too. You mentioned the Rooney Rule, and I've written before about at times when the NBA had gone for a very long period with a low number of black head coaches, and people say, well, does the NBA need a Rooney Rule? We've discussed that at times in this league with regard to the lack of black top executives in front offices. But you note it right off the bat there. Like, it doesn't really work. It gives cover, if anything. It's, well, we've abided by the rule. We interviewed somebody. But if you don't ever hire them, it's not getting you anywhere. So I think the NBA has taken the more constructive approach, in that they've got a lot of internal mechanisms and programs trying to make sure that up and coming, especially on the coaching side, I think it's on the executive side too, but it's we've seen the fruits of that on the coaching side very recently, where they've put them in position to make sure that they are getting fully networked, that they are being put in a position to get these jobs. And it's, I don't know if it's worked, but it certainly is right now, right? We had a whole wave of coaches this past offseason. There are, as I say, 13 black head coaches right now. It's the highest in like nearly a decade. But especially at the front office level, we haven't seen quite as progressive a so with regard to that, and you know NBA front offices, is there anything the NBA could be doing, should be doing there? Is it an issue?
Well, I think you hit on it in the beginning, is that they hired a president of basketball operations, then they hired a bunch of African-Americans that as general managers, so we say we have them. But I think it's more or less not just the title, it's who's making the final decision, who's running it. Masai in Toronto, we know he's running the organization there. So that to me is more cosmetics. When they start naming titles, we have this many, you know, people of color as general managers. But I the one simple thing I think you can do is at the beginning of the year, I think the league can do just a media guide on just executives in the league, and not just African-Americans, not just, but everyone, you know, females, whatever, and do bios and just send it to owners. So if they're at a game and they see somebody working the sideline as a coach, or they bump into somebody, introduces them to an assistant GM, they may not remember the name, they can go back and look and go to the office like, oh, that guy was very impressive. So just to give them information, provided at the beginning of the year, all the board of governors, here, maybe just the governor, here's the information of who's working our league at the executive level, top to bottom down. Here's the coaches, here's the assistant coaches, just so they have it, the information. Not so they can go steal from somebody, but they say, no, who's working the sidelines? You know, there are 30 partners that own these teams. So they should have the information, and it may help them better understand who's on the sideline, who's working in the front office. People of color put pictures with it along with it. They did that, I want to say, 15 years ago, referees. They sent, you know, because we used to do that as a GM, you had to rate the referees. Well, you get the names and you could, and numbers, but you couldn't remember what the person looked like. Then they start sending you the pictures, so you can go with the name. So you can say, oh, yeah, that guy is bad, you know, or that guy's really good.
Oh, yeah. I remember screaming at that guy and F-bombing him. Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, but it was information that helped you when you went back to make the decision. Like, yep. You know, the guy in that game, you knew, oh, that guy really liked that guy. I can, you know, rate him. So to me, it's try to give them as much information. And the one thing they used to do when I first came to the league in 1993, as an assistant coach of the Pacers, they had league meetings. And it was the first year, I think it was in Palm Springs, and every team came, owner, general manager, president of the team, the business side. It was all the executives on the side, the coaches. Every year we were there and had meetings on the day, then at night, then cocktail dinner parties like that. So you got to bump elbows and got to know different people, not just basketball, the business side, owners like that. So you got to know people. And that's, for me coming in the league, it was great because I got to meet the Jerry Sloans of the world and became friends with Jerry Sloan throughout the rest of my career. But that those are things that, you know, they had something in Vegas, but everybody's so busy when you get there, you know, they don't have time. So I think it's they've got to do situations where people put the owners in the rooms. I think these owners are much more progressive in the league, but put them in the room so they can rub elbows and meet people so that they're not just hiring what they know. They are hiring people who they may not know.
Absolutely. And I think the league does some of that. I'm sure there's much more they could be doing along those lines. The last thing I wanted to hit real quick before we get to some trade deadline talk. Flores in his lawsuit also says that he was paid extra for losses by the Dolphins at a time when they wanted to essentially tank. And now Hugh Jackson has come out and said that he got the same with the Browns. We've talked ad nauseum about tanking in the NBA for years, and there have been any number of measures to try to discourage it. But I don't think I've ever heard whispers of bonuses for losses or for higher lottery odds. Any rumblings like that you've ever heard, Billy? Have you ever put that in somebody's contract? You ever pay anybody to lose a few more?
No, because, you know, I remember when we traded Allen here and when I was in Philadelphia, and that was the year Odin was had a consensus number one, Durant was second, and we were, you know, I remember talking to Ed Snyder, and Ed asked me, "Goes, what are your thoughts?" I said, "Well, it's hard to tell guys to lose. It's hard to tell a coach. If you're going to tell a coach to lose, then you've got to be ready to commit to him for long term because this is his career." And Ed goes, "I believe with you 100%. As the owner, I don't want my team ever trying not to win. I want them to out there to performing at their best." And I just don't, when you're paying guys and telling guys to lose on purpose, you build a culture. And all of a sudden, then when it's time to win, you're going to say, okay, now we really want you to win. Well, they're not, you know, to me, losing is habitual, so is winning. If you convince guys that losing is okay and accept it, then when they lose a game when you're supposed to win, how can you get mad at them?
I wonder if it's actually easier to tank in the NFL by design in that sense that, you know, it's a 16-game season. You know, a couple bad weeks and you've already put yourself in a better draft position. In the NBA, you got to really be committed to it.
Yeah, you do. And well, in the NFL, I think it's easy, but it's like, you know, being here in Philadelphia, the Eagles did it last game of the season. They started Jalen Hurts and yanked him midway through the game. And so people knew exactly what they were doing. I mean, you can play the game and you can tell the coach, you know, hey, you know, we want to run the ball, you know. And as a coach, if you know what the draft situation is, you can do it on purpose without nobody telling you. You can, you know, fourth and one, go for it and think, analytics tell me to go for it. So, but I just thinking, I just don't know. You play the game, you keep score for a reason to try to win. And anytime you're asking guys to don't try their best, you're building a culture of losing.
And you've never heard of anybody around the NBA, never been whispers of anybody being incentivized to lose, bonuses for losing the way that Flores and Hugh Jackson are saying they did in the NFL?
I've never heard that. And to me, it's you start looking at it and say, okay, it's easy to find because if they wrote a check, there's a paper trail, you know. So if they all of a sudden this guy was his contract called for this and all of a sudden – there was checks written. I mean, they could do a forensic audit and find out, you know, okay, you wrote them an extra check for $400,000. What was that for? But I've never heard of somebody getting paid in the NBA to lose games. That would be, yeah. I mean, David Stern, you know, God rest his soul, would be, you know, I could see him blowing a gasket on this one.
I think he would be suspending many people, docking many draft picks, and yeah, all hell would have broken loose if it had happened for him.
I would not want to be on the end of that phone call when he would be calling and talking about that.
All right, let's jump into trade deadline stuff because we've got, as I say, about a week to go. You have been in this situation with a week to go and deals on the table, deals in progress, discussions, rumors, people playing with trade machines, you know, fans clamoring for whatever. Like, there's a lot, like, and this gets noisier every year. So what is this last week heading into the trade deadline like when you're a GM of an NBA team? Is it fun? Is it just stressful? Is it all consuming? Is it exhausting? Is it all of the above?
It gets consuming. And as it gets closer, it gets stressful because you have deals that you're working, you think you may get done, but you need deal A to happen in order to do deal B. And so you're trying to push team A to get it done so you can get the deal B. And there are times it could go down to the wire and you're sitting there and team A says, no, we're not going to do it. Now you got to retool deal B. And then what you're trying not to do is the more stuff gets out, other teams try to get in and mess it up and say, I'll give you this for that guy. And so you try to keep it as quiet as possible to get the deals done. Usually the best deals that get done are the ones that aren't out there. Yeah. The ones that are out there in the noise, they're out there for a reason because team A didn't like the deal team B was offering. So they put it out there so that maybe their fan base will get on them or maybe somebody will jump in and make it a three-way or add to it. But it does get stressful as you get closer. I always try to like to get deals done a lot sooner than this because then it allows you to sit back and see if there's something else you can do. But everybody's waiting because they don't want to do a deal because they may like player, you know, two, but they really want player one. And so they don't want to do this deal because it'll affect up that deal. And then the big dominoes always are holding things up. You know, the James Harden, the Bradley Beal, the Damon Lillard, everybody's doesn't want to do a deal for fear they may lose out on them that are trying to get those guys. So it holds up a lot of deals. But then you'll see a flurry of deals happen right before the deadline because teams like, I'm not waiting anymore. Let's move. And then the problem is, as you get closer to 3:00 Eastern time, you know, the clock's ticking and you can't, because there's a lot more paperwork and things that you have to get cleared before you do a deal. Before, you could just call the league up. When I first came to Philadelphia in 97, you just called the league and said, yeah, I'm doing the trade with Milwaukee and here are the players. All right. And then the league said, all right, call us back in 2 hours. And now it's, you've got to send them the, if there's insurance on the players, you got to send it to them. If they, you gotta send the medical stuff in, you got to send all this stuff along with it so that the league can pre-clear the trade. So it's a lot more work that you have to do beforehand, before you can just get on the phone. All right, we got a deal. And the league did that for the fact that teams were backing out on, you know, they did work, get it ready and all things, because now we're not going to do it now. So
I thought of you the other day because the Sacramento Kings, of course, have been tied to Ben Simmons multiple times. And a report came out late last week that and this wasn't anybody saying it on the record. It was just, you know, a report sources say, Kings have bowed out. That's it. We're done. We're out on Ben Simmons. And I kind of chuckled because it reminded me of 2011. You know, I think it's your first season with the Nets. And Mikhail Prokhorov very publicly comes out to say that you're out of the Carmelo Anthony chase. And at that time, to remind people, or if you were not paying attention at the time, the Knicks and the Nets were both pursuing Carmelo very aggressively, being played off of each other probably by the Nuggets to some extent. And Prokhorov, in January of 2011, holds a press conference and he says, this is the quote, "I'm not happy with the way this deal has gone until now. It has taken too long. It has played out in public and it certainly has taken a toll on the players. And I believe it has cost us several games. I think management did a great job, but there comes a time when the price is simply too expensive. I'm instructing our team to walk away from the deal." Billy, I chuckle when the Kings say they're out because no one's ever out. Were you guys out when Mikhail Prokhorov said in January 2011 you were out?
We were out, but I was not out. And in a sense, we were out because it had gone on too public. Now, behind the scenes, I still dabbled a little bit, see if we can get in. And we did get back in and had a meeting with Carmelo, but it wasn't as public as it was. And I remember he was flying in and he told me the night before he's going to make the announcement. Don't tell anybody. He's going to do it on his own. So I was the only one who knew that he was going to make that statement. But that's a situation, like you said, it had become too public. Everything that was, everybody was involved, whether the agents or teams, everything got out. And it was a distraction. By him doing that, it allowed us at least to get to the point where we had a deal in place. If Knicks didn't ante up and put Mozgov in the deal, you know, we would have had Carmelo.
You think it came down to that one last piece? I mean, I remember at the time that was Mozgov was that last piece that they needed to throw in. But you think that was that going to be potentially the deal breaker if the Knicks had not put him in and suddenly Carmelo is a Net and presumably Deron Williams is a Knick?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the one thing that I was told from Denver, that if they put Mozgov in the deal, then we're going to do their deal. So I was hoping that they wouldn't, and they did. And I think it was an all-star game flying back from LA, and I found out that they did that. And then I switched and made a call and did another deal right away.
But it was that close, which also, once again, the lesson here for fans of the game is, when somebody says that we're out on this, this is not me saying, I'm not saying anybody with the Kings is lying about anything. I don't believe it. Like there's so much posturing and so much negotiating through the media, and people have to kind of cover themselves. And, you know, to your point of, and what Prokhorov did then, you also have to kind of protect the team and it can be a distraction. So all those things are said for a reason, but I don't know. I guess I would just ask you, are you as skeptical as I am that the Sacramento Kings are truly out of the running for Ben Simmons?
I think they're out in the sense that the price that Sixers are probably asking for, they're out for that reason. If Sixers come back and say, okay, we'll do this, then they'll get back in. But I think at the price that they know that they have to pay, they're out. And so they're not willing to go forward. But if Philly came back to them and said, okay, we'll do what you originally wanted to do, they'll be in.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really my point here. It's like, we always got to take all this stuff with a grain of salt. So let's play out this scenario with the with Carmelo for a second. Let's say the Knicks balk on Mozgov. You guys, the way you kind of read this, you end up with Carmelo. Does Carmelo stay? Because he had always said, you know, the indication was he didn't want to be in New Jersey, which is where you guys still were at the time. You were still a year and a half or so away from getting to Brooklyn. Does Carmelo end up re-upping with the Nets? And does Deron Williams end up with the Knicks?
I don't know if Deron ends up with the Knicks, but I was pretty confident that we could have signed him to an extension because he wanted that extension that season.
Yes.
So we would, you know, put it on the table, and I think he would have signed, and he'd have been in Brooklyn and playing there. And I'm not sure if the Knicks would have pivoted and gone, because they still had a lot of pieces that Donnie Walsh had collected. So I'm not sure if they would have pivoted and gave up with, you know, the two first round picks for Deron. They may have, but I don't think anybody. I had a relation with Kevin O'Connor because he and I had worked together. So I don't know if New York knew, Donnie Walsh knew that Deron was available. Yeah, and I don't know if Kevin may have called them, but Deron may end up in Dallas at that point, though. They may have done a deal and put him in Dallas.
Yeah, no, Dallas had certainly been chasing him for a while, too. Aside from that deal, the Carmelo deal, anything during your Sixers tenure, your Nets tenure, it's maybe specific to the trade deadline, but maybe not. But we're at this time of year that you thought was going to happen, something that got really close. You talked about your plan A's and your plan B's, and sometimes these things are predicated on each other. Is there a deal in, you know, one of your tenures there, Nets or Sixers, where you thought it was there and then suddenly it wasn't?
Well, it goes back to when I was at the Nets before going to Brooklyn, you know, went to bed, pretty much had a deal in place for Dwight Howard. And I thought that it was, you know, we were going to wake up in the morning to finalize it because Otis had to present it to the ownership. And I woke up to a text, and I don't know who it was from, said, "Did you hear Dwight opted in?" And I said, "No." And so then I started calling his agent, and he didn't know. He said, "Let me find out." And then, you know, and even Orlando, Otis and I still went forward and figured out what the deal would be, because he didn't know either. Otis didn't know, the GM of Orlando. And then he called back and said, "Yep, he opted in." So he says, you know, "We'll keep the papers. You know, this may change this summer, but he's opted in, so we're not trading him."
That was the Dwightmare, as I recall. It was
labeled. Went through a few.
We had the melodrama, then there was the Dwightmare.
Yeah.
You're involved in all of these.
I know. You know, the ironic one I had, I think it was my first year here in Philadelphia, maybe my second year, on trade deadline. I remember we were in Indiana, and we had done so many deals, and we were playing Indiana tonight, and we could do one more deal. And I'm not sure who the player was, but we could have got one more. It was Ronnie Cicely. We could have made a trade to get him. It wasn't giving up a lot, but we needed eight players to play tonight. If we made that deal, we were only going to have seven. And so we couldn't do the deal. So we did quite a few deals in my days.
You did. I was scrolling through Basketball Reference during your years in Philly and with the Nets. You made a lot of in-season deals. Not all of these are necessarily at the deadline itself, but Deron Williams, you acquire in season of 2011, close to the deadline. Gerald Wallace the next year in 2012. Some smaller deals in 2014 and 15, when you flipped Kevin Garnett later for Thaddeus Young. With the Sixers, you acquired Chris Webber from the Kings in February of 2005. So that was, I think, close to the deadline. Traded Iverson to the Nuggets December of 2006. Acquired Tony Kukoc in February 2000. The next year, you traded him in a deal for Dikembe Mutombo. So not, like I said, not all of these are right at the deadline, but these are all in-season trades and in the weeks leading to it. Any of those that was the most memorable or the most stressful?
Probably the toughest one was doing the Mutombo deal, because we were number one in the East. Theo Ratliff was an all-star at the time. He had just broke his wrist, and the team had been together. There was great chemistry, but, you know, Larry and I felt that, and I didn't know when Theo was coming back. He just had surgery on the wrist, and we were afraid that if we wait too long, by the time he gets back, get in shape and get the chemistry going, you know, we may not get there. And we thought Dikembe, if we're going to get to the finals, we're probably going to face a Shaq, and we needed that defensive force inside. So that was the one that was stressful, because you're making a blockbuster trade. We were number one team in the East, and you're trading, you know, getting an All-Star Hall of Famer back, but still you're breaking up a team. And that's the hardest thing during the season. When you make a trade with a team that's really good, if you look at Sixers right now, they're a half a game, I think, out of first in the East. And, you know, if they trade me something, no matter what they bring back in, then they got to fit them all in the rotation. And I think somebody said this after the Mutombo trade, if you just looked at our record, counting the playoff games, we were a 500 team, even though we got to the finals. But record wise, we were a 500 team.
But you needed him, right? I mean, it's, you know, that was just a necessity. And besides that, you make the finals. Like there's no, you know, can't second guess the results on that.
No, you don't. But that's the problem. If you look at some of the, like Donnie Walsh rarely made trades during the season. And that was one of my mentors. Miami, Pat Riley rarely would make a trade during the season. There's certain teams that rarely do anything major during the season. Then there's some teams like that do a lot, but those are two off the top of my head that rarely make a move during the season.
No, the Spurs too. The Spurs are infamous for that. But you were at the other end of the spectrum. Why do you think you were more likely to make in season deals than others?
Well, in Philly, I had Larry Brown. And so
and with Larry, that explains everything.
Yeah. And I love Larry, but Larry always wanted more. He wanted, he would think we needed another defender. We needed another guy that can dribble, penetrate. So he was always pushing. Like Larry, before the trade deadline, he was in my office, especially the couple weeks before. He'd come in before practice. He'd come in after practice and sit for 2-3 hours. The day after the trade deadline, he never came to office. I had to go find him.
That's funny. Well, I mean, that was the book on Larry, right? Falling in and out of love with players at the drop of a hat. So, you mentioned Philly and in-season trades and everything, and how they're tough to pull off. They can mess with chemistry, and the Sixers right now are a team that, despite the absence of Ben Simmons or anything that you could get in return for Ben Simmons, they're right in the thick of things. Like there's actually it's plausible for the Sixers to make the finals with no Ben Simmons and no trade package for Ben Simmons. Like that's it's not that outlandish to think right now. The East is that tight and that fluid. And Joel Embiid has been incredible. So it could happen, but it's such an interesting position for them to be in, Billy. So let me just ask you, like the stance in general has been, they want to hold out for, whether it's a top 20 player, top whatever, a Bradley Beal, a Damian Lillard, a James Harden, whoever. And if it takes till the summer to do it, the offseason to do it, they're willing to do that. Is that the right stance? Like, is it right to hold out? Basically saying like, yeah, it may hurt us in the short term here. And we may fall short of the finals despite Joel Embiid playing like an MVP. But ultimately, the long term is more secure if you get the better player. Like, I see the logic there, but I see the obviously the drawbacks too. So what's the calculus there?
Well, I think Daryl would have liked to have done something in November or December if he could have.
Sure.
But now as this team has evolved, Maxi has become a pretty important piece for them. It's playing pretty well and it's benefited from Ben not being there. I think Tyrese, Thibault, sorry, you know,
Matisse,
he's become understanding his role. So I think the team has evolved. And so now if they look at it, what they may be looking for may have changed. They may say, yeah, if we can get a Harden, great. That's not going to happen until the summer. If we can get a Bill, great. That may not happen until the summer. So now I think Daryl is looking, okay, I'm not just going to trade Ben to bring in just pieces just to say, okay, we got pieces, especially the pieces that doesn't help them acquire a superstar this summer or to make this team good. Because I keep telling you, if they make a trade now just to try to a couple pieces to win and just give Ben away and get some picks, whatever, and it doesn't work, then this summer, what do they have next to try to make the team better? And when you're looking at the NBA salary cap, the bigger salaries you have, the easier it is to make a deal, the less pieces you got to put into deal. So if they trade Ben for 2 or 3 guys making $8 million and one of them is expiring, so this summer now they have less pieces to go get a bigger contract. I mean, you're talking guys making 40 or 35 million. So you're looking at the economics of that. And I just think that they don't want to take this. And people might say, well, he's losing value. He'll have value this summer because in the summertime, everybody's thinking like, okay, we weren't as good. I got to make us better. Who's available? All right, Ben Simmons, let's make a move for him. So, and it's easier to do deals in the summertime because the roster, during the summer, you're limited to 15 roster spots. During the summertime, you have more roster spots to bring pieces in. So you can do a 4-for-1 and it's not affecting your roster during the season.
Yeah. Plus you've got, you know, teams have cap room. You can use other teams to get involved, to offload some players to make the cap stuff work. There's just a lot more flexibility for everyone, right?
And teams draft order by then too. So, you know, okay, they have this pick. So now we like this guy. So now, not only are we getting now, instead of getting a pick that you don't know what's going to be there, now, you know, okay, we're getting the 7th pick. We like these 10 players. So we're going to get a player that we like to go along with this. So there's more assets and players available after the season when you get into the June and July.
It sounds like if you were in this situation, Billy, you'd kind of take the same stance. Like you're trying to maximize the asset. You can only spend the Ben Simmons chip once.
Yeah. And also is the fact Ben's leverage was going to be better if the team wasn't winning. If this team was struggling, then it'd be a lot more pressure on Daryl to do something. But what the team has done is won by Joel Embiid's in play and the team building a plan around them. So now there's not as much pressure. Now people say, well, they're wasting Joel's greatest year, whatever. They got to get something for him. And then if they do that and they don't win, they're like, oh, they just gave Ben away and this team's not any good. They got to trade Joel. Yeah. So yeah. I think they got to, by winning and putting themselves in the position they are now, there's less pressure to do something by the deadline.
I agree. This whole situation started, Billy, because, and it's, I'm not sure we truly know why, because Ben Simmons has never actually explained it, and I don't know that he ever will. But presumably, it's because, you know, Doc Rivers and Joel Embiid said some things that were, you know, whatever, mean, critical. They weren't even that mean, and they weren't even that critical. But they said some things in the wake of that loss in the playoffs last season. Obviously, Ben Simmons was aware that Daryl had tried to trade him for James Harden. None of these things, Billy, are new. You and I have both been around this league a long time. You a little bit longer than me, but we've both been around a while. Coaches criticizing their players publicly, teammates sometimes criticizing their teammates. Obviously, I covered Shaq and Kobe for 7 years. At any given day, those guys were saying something, and at any given day, Phil Jackson was saying something about one or both of them. Like, it used to be common. You worked with Larry Brown for a long time, somebody you're very close to. Larry was never shy about talking about his players and their shortcomings. George Karl, like
Jeff Van Gundy.
This used to be common. I think in general, the league has gotten a lot, less candid in that regard. I think coaches and GMs don't say as much as they used to. But I also have not seen anything as extreme as a player hearing these things and saying, that's it, I can't play for you anymore. Like, it's still shocking to me that Ben Simmons has held out this long at the cost of millions of dollars to himself and at the cost of handicapping the 76ers season because some people said some things that he didn't like and he just couldn't get over it. I don't want to seem insensitive on this, Billy, but I've seen too many of these situations where guys just kind of, get through it. You patch it up and you move on. And as we always say in the league, like, you don't have to be best friends, right? Like, it's, that's a old cliche. Like, you don't have to like each other. You just got to play well together. Like, have you ever seen anything like this? Is there anything about it where you say, yeah, I kind of understand it?
No, not at all. I've never seen it because, like you said, Phil Jackson wrote a book critical of players and the Laker organization, went back and coached. And then they won a championship.
He called Kobe uncoachable in print and then went back and coached him.
And that's the thing about it is where I think Ben put himself on a box that now he doesn't know how to get out, because when his teammates reached out to him, he didn't want to talk to them. When the team they finally had a meeting, he said, I don't want to be there. So he put himself in this box that usually guys will say something and then they come out and they say, yeah, we talked it out. Now we're okay. But he put himself in a box that, and I think the team thought, okay, he'll be back. He'll come play. Because everybody eventually does. They just say, okay, I got a job to do. I want to go play. And to me, that's my question about Ben is, like, most guys love to play basketball. So at the end of the day, they may not like their teammates, but they're going to go out and play because it's their brand that they're performing. When you say, I don't want to play in this city, I'm never going to play in that city again. I mean, you and you've got a long-term contract. You've painted yourself in a bad box that, you know, and you're a young player. So now you got to come back here and play in this city if you get traded at some point. And you're going to go to other cities and they're going to be critical of you. I just think that he put himself in a box that, you know, he couldn't get out of. And now he could miss the whole year of not playing and hope that he gets traded this summer. Because if he doesn't get traded this summer, you know, I don't foresee them giving in and just pay him. It's somewhere where there needs to be some kind of mediation. Somebody needs to sit down and talk to him and say, okay, how do we resolve this? How do we get, if you're not traded, how do we get you back on the court? And I don't know if the problem is, I don't know if he can come back and play. No, I don't say I don't know. I know he cannot come back and play for the 76ers just because I think there's been too much bridge has been burned here. And it's just the fan base, the teammates. You can be mad at an organization, you can be mad at the coach, ownership, whatever. But when you turn your back on your teammates, to me, that's something that you can't redo. And I think that's what he did when he didn't want to meet with them. To me, you're part of a brotherhood when you're playing on a team. And when you turn your back on your teammates and say, and they said, we'll fly out to see you, and you say, no, don't come, that's hard to recover from.
Yeah, and I'll add on this part too. Like, if you're one of those teams that's chasing Ben Simmons, you got to take that into account too. Like, on the one hand, he's an incredible talent, and he could change the face of any team that acquires him. And so, you know, someone's going to eventually give up something very valuable to get him, and they should. He's that talented. But if I'm another team pursuing Ben Simmons, I am also considering all of this. I would have those concerns. Like, how long is our honeymoon with him? Are we walking on eggshells all the time about what we say publicly, privately, his role? You know, what if the team that acquires him says, you know what, you're great with the ball in your hands, but we want a primary ball handler who actually can and will shoot. We think you're better off as a secondary ball handler. We're plugging you in at power forward.
Yeah.
Like, do you lose him right off the bat? Like, I don't know. Like, it just, I would have serious concerns about the makeup there. There is a theory, by the way, Billy, out there, and you've already kind of squashed it, but there's this theory that everybody's kind of laying the groundwork for on both sides, but especially on the Sixers side to bring him back, that they don't make a deal by February 10th. And suddenly he just shows up one day and he's back and he's playing. And like, I'm highly skeptical of that theory. I get it. I could see why all parties might want to do that. And it would give the Sixers, you know, a runway to try to win a championship and then still trade him in the offseason. And maybe by that time, Bradley Beal is available. I can't see it. You know that market. You know those fans.
Yeah, I just don't see it. I just think that, you know, especially when the latest story came out from Ramona saying that, you know, Ben is upset with Joel because Joel blamed him for the loss. And I don't know how you just, you know, especially that point in the season, you're talking February 10th, you know, there's All-Star break. And now, you know, because when you get into February and March, that's where you're putting yourself in your position for seeding. So I don't know. I know the fan base would not welcome him back here. And that's it. If he couldn't take the criticism from Doc or Joel, he's not going to be able to take it from the fans, because you can say we want him back and they can say all the right things, but the fan base themselves will not, they're not going to forgive him.
Yeah. I can't see it. I think it'd be absolutely brutal and probably would exceed what we saw for LeBron's reception the first time he went back to Cleveland with Miami. Yeah. And that was the single ugliest situation I've ever seen. A couple more before I get you out of here. I try to not to put you in a bad spot with regard to your other former employer, the Nets, but like the Kyrie situation is really interesting to me. And there's been no indication that they want to trade him. I think they just are hoping at some point circumstances change and they can play him full time, home and road. But right now they can't, and they want to win a championship. Would you, if you're in this situation, would you rather trade him so that you've got pieces that can, you know, players that can play? They may not be of same value. It's hard to replicate Kyrie. but you'd have a complete team at least, home and road. Or would you be okay with having a guy as a part-time player?
Well, I mean, at this point, I would take what you can get. And I would have to ride it out and just see, even if you're figuring, okay, he won't be able to play. We have home court advantage, the two home games. But if we can win those two, then we have him for the road, which is the tougher games anyway. You have a chance to win a championship and hope that maybe by springtime, the COVID rules do relax and things go in the right direction. But I think they have to ride it out now with these three, the way it is, the way the cards are laid out, and then look at everything this summer. Because if you've built it as these three and whatever, and I think that it'd be hard to replace them and bring somebody back, and all of a sudden now it doesn't work, and everybody will say, what if? They sold it. Is this what we're going to do? When they brought him back, they knew that it may not change. You may only have him part-time for the playoffs. So to me, is you got to ride it out and see how it goes. And then if you don't win a championship, then you got to look at and say, okay, now let's look back and say, okay, what do we do going forward? Because this hasn't worked.
Yeah. It's just tough. Like, I mean, this is obviously a completely unprecedented situation. Both these situations, Simmons and Kyrie, like, I don't think I've ever seen anything even remotely analogous. The idea that that's could go into the playoffs trying to win a championship with one of their best players only playing half of every series is just mind-boggling.
And the amazing thing is, if you're a visiting team now, you're going in thinking, hey, if we can steal one of those home games, now we have home court advantage, steal one of those games because, even they may have Kyrie in the road, but we can win. We know we can come back here and win a game. So those games, to me, there's more pressure on the Nets for those home games to win those games because you don't want to lose those games. Even though you can have Kyrie in the road, they're going to be playing at home. So to me, the pressure falls squarely on them to win those games. Because if Brooklyn says, we win our home games, then we can go get Kyrie back. Now we win the road games. They lose one of the games, the pressure becomes enormous.
Last thing here, just a curiosity, just as more of kind of like a philosophy of team building and knowing when to strike kind of thing. The Cavaliers and the Grizzlies are both having these just phenomenal breakthrough seasons. The Cavs and Grizzlies are both pretty young. I don't think either team expected to be, and nobody else expected them to be this good this soon. And so at a time like now, there's all this talk of, is this the time to strike? Is it time to go all in? Should they be, buying at the trade deadline? I think it's a really fascinating discussion, especially with the Cavs, where there's Kevin Love, who it's always been a matter of, could they offload Kevin Love? And now now he's kind of critical to their success. With either or both of those teams, how do you see them? And when, as a GM, do you know that it's the time to be all in?
Well, we'll go back to the 2001 year. We talked about, we did the deal for Mutombo. When Larry and I got here, we built the team. We traded Stackhouse for a young Theo Ratliff and Aaron McKee. Then we traded for Eric Snow with a second round pick, signed George Lynch, had Larry Hughes, but traded him for Tyrone Hill because we needed a power forward. And that team started to gel. And then the next year we ended up, traded Tim Thomas for Tyrone Hill, traded Larry Hughes for Tony Kukoc. And those were getting that we needed to go with the young team. And then when we got to we had the best record playing well, that's when we struck to get Mutombo. So I had the chance to watch Memphis up close. I think they got a great team. They got great chemistry and why they're playing so well. To me, you got to let them play out, let them get that experience as a young group in the playoffs, and then come back the following year and look at it and say, okay, what do we need to add to the team? It may be a veteran this or veteran that. But I think you can't affect the chemistry because they all know their minutes. And when guys, especially young guys, they're trying to make their mark on the league. And so when they know they're playing and they can make their mark, when you take that away from them and the uncertainty comes in, that's when they start griping, I'm not getting my minutes. You're affecting my brand. You're affecting me. So I think they've got great chemistry. So you make the move when the move is going to be the deal that gets you this move will get us to the championship. This will get us over the hump. And I don't think that either one of them are in that position right now. And with Memphis, they got a great player in Ja Morant. So they got time to just be patient because he is going to be that next star that no matter what you put with him, they're going to win because he's that good. And so they don't have to hurry. You know, Cleveland, I think they've got a good team. They may be a little – their window may be sooner than Memphis. I think Memphis can let it grow like they did with Marc Gasol when they had the Zebo down there, Conley. They just let that thing just keep building and building. But you'll know when you're there and think, if we can get this one piece. Because in general, in order to get the strike, it's going to take one of those young pieces. So you got to let them, you know, grow and grow until they're the point where it's okay to move one of them. They're not a young piece.
Yeah. And I think in both those cases, obviously, they can afford to be patient. You know, they just kind of arrived. They've got good young cores. There's certainly time. There's not necessarily an urgency. I'm sure the Cavaliers fans might disagree because it's, you know, LeBron leaves and you're in the cellar and you're trying to just get back. The Grizzlies have rebounded so quickly from the Gasol and Conley era. Like I think for them, it's they've got built a lot of goodwill. So it's interesting. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens soon enough. Hopefully it hasn't already happened by the time this podcast posts. But Billy, been great catching up. Appreciate you spending the time. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Billy King for joining me. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated podcast channel on YouTube. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.